Indeed, this morning we certainly welcome you into this assembly. This is a holiday weekend, and what that means is I'm sure that there are some that are normally here that are gone in other places, and there are, I'm sure, those who are visiting with us. And my difficulty this morning is trying to sort out, in many instances, who's visiting and who here that normally is here. And I'll do the best that I can, and Cherie will as well, trying to sort everybody out as quickly as we possibly can. My failure and shortcoming is that faces are always very familiar. It just takes me a little while with the names. So if you can be patient, I wish I only had one to learn like you all, rather than 175 or 200. It goes a lot faster that way. But it's good to be here. We've anticipated moving. We've looked forward to it. We look more forward to getting everything out of the boxes and not to have any boxes around for a while. It just seems like that's what we've been living with for a while. And as Brother Terrell has suggested, our children are at my mother and dad's in West Virginia. And that really, you'll come to find out, unless something with health or whatever changes, is a kind of a normal occurrence for us in the summertime. They seemingly want to be there more than they want to be with us. And so they spend a good deal of time taking turns and going together to be at my mother and dad's in West Virginia. And so that it would be a little easier on them, and certainly easier on Cherie and I. We went ahead and allowed them to go. And I talked with them last night. The boys are ready to come right now. Erin said, of course, when she's with her grandmother and she's the only granddaughter in the whole family, you know why she likes to be at grandmother's. She said, well, yeah, I guess I'm ready to come if you want me. So that lets you know how well she likes being over there. But everything goes all right. They're supposed to be here next Friday. I grew up on the Ohio River, living on both sides for a while, though born in West Virginia and living there most of my life. And I can remember some things that are very characteristic of when I was a child. One of them was that section of the river has an awful lot of steel mills, chemical plants, and where my father works, it hydroelectric plants to produce energy. And I can remember that one of the first tasks for years that my mother had as a boy was she'd go out and sweep the front porch off, and she'd have to do it every morning. And the reason was, overnight, the fly ash coming out of the power plants would put a thin layer of black soot and silt everywhere, and so she'd go out and sweep it off so that anybody coming and going wouldn't track it into the house. And you know, everybody thought, well, that's just a natural thing. That's just something you live with there. I mean, after all, it indicated that the economy was prospering. It indicated there were jobs. It indicated things were thriving. And so it was just something that we lived with and that we accepted. You know, it would have been an entirely different matter if now that we are working so hard to try to clean up our pollution in the air, if somewhere along the line some folks would have gone out and taken a real deep breath of some of that air and they'd have got real sick, or they'd have just keeled over dead. I mean, if that would have happened, everybody would have been saying that while it's true these are jobs, and while it's true these are good times, and while this is true economies are booming, we've got to do something about the quality of our air because it's affecting us. But you see, it didn't develop like that overnight, and it wasn't going to be changed overnight. And I can remember stomping around the river a lot. And I can still remember that about the time I was a child, they were doing an awful lot of work along many of those towns on the river in putting in sewage disposal plants. And you see, for years they'd been told before that it was all right to dump raw sewage in the river. I mean, they were saying, give nature 30 miles to work on that, and at the end of 30 miles, well, the water will be as pure and as clean as if you'd never done that. The only thing was, I guess they weren't thinking about the fact you wouldn't go along that river and go 30 miles, but what there was a town doing the same thing. And then they didn't think about the size of some of those cities along the river, and the next thing you know, the water was just polluted. Again, you know, if one morning people would have gone to the tap and they'd have got a glass of water and there'd have been all kinds of stuff floating around in it, we'd have said, hey, we can't live with this. Something's got to be done.
Or even if it hadn't have been and you'd have drunk that glass of water and got deathly sick and people would have died, we'd have been saying, something's got to be done, and it's got to be done right now. But you see, it was a gradual, slow kind of a process that now we are trying to undo insofar as pollution is concerned. You know, I'm really not concerned this morning about pollution in our land insofar as our study is concerned. But it seems to me that in regard to those kinds of things, that there is a sense in which we and I can learn a good lesson. And that is about the stranglehold of the pollution of sin as it tries to destroy in us what we have sung about this morning, and that is the hope of heaven. You know, generally, and I know there are exceptions to the rule, if somebody quits the Lord, if they just stop being faithful to God, they generally don't just quit. I mean, they're not the kind of person who's here this morning and they say, that's it, I've had all I want to take of that, no more, I quit right now, walk out the door, and that's the end of it. Now, I admit, I know a case or two where that's exactly the way that it was. But you know, generally, it's a very gradual, slow process, isn't it? And in the process in which they do that, they not only accustom themselves to what they're doing, they likewise accustom to the rest of us to it as well. And it goes something like this. We'll start maybe not being in the midweek assembly. And pretty soon, maybe it's noticed a little bit along the way, but pretty soon we kind of get used to the fact that they just don't come on Wednesday night or Thursday night or whatever the midweek assembly may be. And then maybe they stop coming to Bible class or Bible study on Sunday mornings. And after a while, we kind of get used to that. And then they stop coming Lord's Day evenings. And then we kind of get adjusted to that. And then we miss a Sunday morning here and a Sunday morning there. We string two or three together. Pretty soon we're not coming. And you know what happens? All of a sudden somebody says, whatever happened to brother or sister so-and-so? And somebody will say, well, you know something? I don't think I've seen them in a little bit. I don't know. I just don't think they're coming right now. And by the time you and I get out there and we try to find out what's going on, if there's something that can be done or we can help, generally what's happened is they've separated themselves from the fellowship of the saints and from God, and they did it in such a gradual, slow kind of process that we became accustomed to doing that, that it's generally too late at that juncture for us to do much about it. It's just kind of like what took place in the air pollution or the water pollution in our country. It was justifiable as we looked at it, though we knew it was something that needed to be dealt with, and it just gradually strangled the life out of the things that we were trying to do. And that's what happens sometimes with our spirituality. Sometimes as we try, as we've sung this morning, to live by faith, what happens is the devil's working very diligently to try to strangle the spiritual life out of us. I mean, after all, just as we sang, living by faith, we walk by faith and not by sight. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 7. And yet, even though that's what we do, so many times we look at the situation and we hear people say, I'm not willing to do that. If I can't see it, if I don't know for sure that it's there, then I'm not going to put forth the effort. And I've never seen God. I've never seen the Lord. I've never seen heaven. I've never seen hell, and nobody else has that's living. And so these places don't exist, or these people don't exist. And that's the reason why there are some folks that come along today and they say things like, if there is a hell, it's only if you make a mess of your life. It's only lived in this life if you become a drug addict or an alcoholic, or if you get involved in some kind of a marital situation to where you're just miserable in that, or you just never can be happy that way, or if something happens maybe physically to your health and you just live in agony and torment because of physical problems. That's the only hell there'll ever be, because you see, they just don't believe in something they cannot see. And the same thing sometimes is viewed even about things like heaven. That the only heaven there is, I saw a statement in the Akron Beacon Journal from a person just the other day that indicated that if there was anything that was heaven, it was just the fact that you were fortunate enough that you chose well when you married and your children turned out well somehow or another accidentally when they grew up. They didn't give you too many hardships or they didn't give you any problems growing up. and they've become model citizens, and they're hard, diligent workers, and your life just kind of flows along evenly and smoothly, and you're really not having a great many difficulties, and so with all of that, you're very fortunate. And that's the only heaven there is, that guy said. Well, the Bible teaches otherwise. And you and I must learn that we walk by faith and not by sight. And yet, sometimes what the devil tries to do is to convince us other than that. He wants to take our eye off of the fact that we live by faith and try to get us centered and zeroed in on the things that are seen. And I'm going to tell you something. He can be very successful at that. He can produce within us an attitude that basically says, I'm going to live according to the philosophy that seeing is believing. And if you don't think he can work that very well, let me suggest to you that if he could do it with one of the apostles of the Lord, he can do it with you and I. And he did it with one of them. Turn with me now to the 20th chapter of the Gospel of John. Look in verse 19. The same day at evening, being the first day of the week, when the doors were shut, where the disciples were assembled for fear of the Jews, came Jesus and stood in the midst and said unto them, Peace be unto you. And when he had so said, he showed them his hands and his side. Then were the disciples glad when they saw the Lord. Now here is Jesus after he's been crucified, and he has been raised, and he shows himself to be alive to the disciples. However, notice in verse 24, but Thomas, one of the 12 called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. Oh, now all of a sudden somebody has not been in the group. And we're going to particularly zero in on Thomas. And everybody knows this story because this is the occasion that we call Doubting Thomas. And what happens? Well, the other disciples, you can just almost see them. They're just chock full of enthusiasm. They're just running over because the Lord has been raised like he said he was going to be. He now is living again. The other disciples therefore said unto him, We've seen the Lord. Now what's Thomas's reaction? He says, But he said unto them, Except I shall see in the hands the print of the nails, and put my finger in the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side. Now watch it. I will not believe. What's he saying? He's saying, I've got to physically see. He's saying, seeing is believing. I've got to examine the evidence. I've got to see where they nailed his hands and feet to the cross. I've got to see where his side was pierced, and I've got to examine that and handle that, and until or unless I do that, I refuse to believe that you fellows have seen the Lord. And from this we say, now this is Doubting Thomas. And you know, there's a sense in which certainly Thomas ought to be labeled that way. I mean, after all, the others, he's seen the same things they have seen. The evidence and the testimony that they give, there's no reason for him to doubt that they would make it up to pull a grandiose joke upon him, as it were. But on the other hand, really, maybe there's a sense in which what Thomas is doing is demanding evidence. And that's what he calls for. But in doing so, he says, I only accept evidence that I can see. Now watch what happens. And after 8 days again, his disciples were within, and Thomas with them. Then came Jesus, the doors being shut, and stood in the midst and said, Peace be unto you. Notice now, on another first day of the week, the Lord appears, and this time Thomas is with that group. Now Jesus knows what Thomas has said. He said to Thomas, Reach hither thy finger, and behold my hands. And reach hither thy hand, and thrust it into my side, and be not faithless, but believing. In other words, Jesus says, Now Thomas, I know what you said. Here I am. Here is the evidence that you said you would not believe that I am risen from the dead except you handle. Look at my hands and feet. Examine them. Touch them. Look at my side. Put your hand therein and be not faithless but believing. Will you be true to what you said? You said seeing would be believing. Now what are you going to do with the evidence? And he makes the strongest affirmation that a Jew could ever make when Thomas answered and said unto him, My Lord and my God. And the reason for that is he's now confessing the deity of Jesus Christ. He was faithful to that. Now notice Jesus' response. Jesus saith unto him, Thomas, because thou hast seen me, thou hast believed. Blessed are they that have not seen and yet have believed. And isn't that exactly where you and I are today? I mean, can you imagine these people who are running around saying, I will not believe that Jesus Christ is unless I can do what Thomas said. If that's your attitude, forget it. Because you're never going to get the opportunity to do that until it's too late. Jesus says, Thomas, you made the statement, seeing is believing, and you had the opportunity, and at least you were faithful to the commitment that you had made. But Thomas, I want you to understand something. There are going to be people who are not going to be able to do what you did, but who will have the same confident faith in me and my resurrection that you had by examining the evidence, because they're going to believe the reliable testimony of witnesses such as yourself. And it will produce exactly the same thing in them. Do you see now why John concludes this chapter in probably some verses that are most familiar to most of us in the way that he does in verses 30 and 31? And many other signs did Jesus, truly in the presence of this book, or in the presence of his disciples, which are not written in this book. But these are written that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you might have life in his name. Why is it that he said what he said? Why did John say, I wrote the things that I wrote? Because you can't say seeing is believing. Because this is the testimony that declares that I am the Son of God. And if you accept this evidence, then it's the same as if you actually did what Thomas did. As if you handled the evidence of the Lord. Now, you know, people come along, though, in religion, they say, well, that's different. I refuse to accept that there. Seeing is believing in life. Now let me ask you, isn't that really a rather ridiculous, sometimes even absurd kind of claim? I mean, do we really have that same attitude in everything in life? Let me ask you something. Have you ever seen electricity? Now you see the fruit of it this morning. And I'm going to tell you, for a little while, I worked in one of those plants down there on the river where you produce electricity. And I saw the generators and the turbines. And I saw the soot blowers and the boilers. And I worked in some of the dirtiest jobs that could ever be, to where I'd come in at night and the only thing white about me would be my eyeballs. And my dad was trying to get me to learn a lesson in seeing that I worked there a while. I saw all of it, but I did not see electricity. I can see the fruit of it, the evidence of it, but I don't see it. Let me ask you, have you ever seen gravity? We talk about the law of gravity. Have you ever seen gravity? It holds you in your seat this morning, but have you ever seen it? Or what about the atom? We split the thing and we can do all kinds of damage, or we can produce the greatest amount of energy that can make cities run electrically just for years. But have you ever seen it? You see, how different it is sometimes in religion. In the thing we don't want to see about God or about Christ or about the Bible or about heaven or hell as the eternal destinies of man. And so we come along and we say, well, I just refuse to believe that. But that's not the way we operate in every area of life. You see, we don't have this same philosophy in some others. And that's what we see about God this morning, is the evidence that God is. And therefore we believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, by virtue of the testimony of reliable witnesses, as Jesus talks about. But yet, as we strive to do that, how does the devil reach down and try to strangle the spiritual life out of us? Well, think about just a couple of statements that all of us make. And yet I wonder sometimes, though we make the statement, if we realize really the importance of it. You take, for example, the things that are physical. We realize these are temporal things. They're transitory things. They're things that are rapidly passing away. We say that death and decay are written on the wings of time, and yet what do? Sometimes we spend more time thinking and planning and purposing and working toward the things that are temporary and transitory, even to the sacrifice of some of those things that are spiritual and eternal in their nature. We allow them to take precedence in our life over the things of God. And you see, what happens is we get our priorities out of line. And when we do that, we forget that maybe what's happening is that the devil is trying to strangle the spiritual life out of us. If he can get you to zero your attention on things that are temporal rather than on things that are eternal, he's got you.
Now look at it. In 2 Corinthians chapter 4, Paul says in verse 16, "For which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day." Paul starts out by telling us man is a dual being. There is an outward and an inward part of man. And he says the outward part of man perishes every day. And that's true, isn't it? Oh, you don't notice it. You know why you don't notice it? Because you look at yourself in the mirror every day. You put your makeup on, you come along, shave every day, you comb your hair. You don't see those changes that slowly and gradually take place. Do you know when it's noticed? Well, it's noticed when all of a sudden you see somebody you haven't seen in a while. Maybe you've not seen them for 5 years or 2 or 3 years. And you go and you talk and everything's pleasant, you know, and you're talking about people and places. Do you remember this? But I guarantee you, this is what happens when you walk away from a situation like that. You walk away and you nudge your companion and say, my, haven't they gotten old? Did you see how many wrinkles they've got? And did you see that gray hair? He's getting bald, isn't he? I'll just tell you, you can really see their age. And do you know what's happening? As they walk away, they're saying the same thing about you. Why? Because the outward man perishes day by day. And yet it's a gradual, slow changing process that we don't recognize. That's why your kids get tickled when they do what my kids do, and that is they get out a family album and they look at it and they say, "Do you mean you really wore clothes like that, Dad? I can't believe that. You really wore your hair like that, Mother? I can't believe you'd do that." And even sometimes you do it yourself. While packing to move down here, I ran across, I was going to throw a thing out, and I thought, well, I better check and see what's in it. And there were some photographs. And I said, "Cherie, you're not going to believe it. Look at this." And it was pictures that were taken shortly after we were married. And she got looking through them. Of course, she quit doing what she was doing. I just went right on. And she got looking through those things, and she said, "I can't believe how skinny I was." And I said, "Yeah, I can't believe it either. You were hardly there." And I said, "Have you noticed I lost weight since then?" But isn't that how it happens? And that's what Paul's saying here, isn't it? He's saying the outward man perishes day by day. But look at it. He says there's another part of man. You know, sometimes we get worried about aging. I went over the hill last year. And everybody where I preach up there made sure that it was known by everybody else too. And especially by me. But you know what? I didn't feel like I was that old, and still don't. Now, there's an inward part of man that doesn't do what the outward part of man does unless you let it. There's an inward part of man that is renewed day by day. And Paul said, that's how you've got to look at life. And when you do that, notice how it affects the outward man. In verse 17, "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory." You know what? You look at that outward man and you think of all of the afflictions that these folks went through and that they suffered, and you say, how can he say it was a light affliction? You read Paul's account of the things he suffered for the Lord. The times he was beaten, the time he was imprisoned. You think of the stoning and you say, how can he say it was light? How can he say it was but for a moment? He says, I'm not looking at it from the outward man's perspective, but from the inward man's perspective. The outward man would say, no way am I going to let you beat me. You're going to take years off of this body. I'm not going to be here as long after I go through that. If I allow that to happen, I'll renounce before I do that. But he said, not so. He said, we look at the things that are internal, which work for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. Now, how do you know that was his perspective? Because that's what he says, isn't it? Verse 18, "While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things that are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal." Notice here now, he wants us to recognize that we've got to develop a perspective of life. As we strive to live by faith to go to heaven when we die, that doesn't develop into seeing as believing, but that causes us to realize that what we need day by day to renew and to feed and to care for, to nurture and to develop, is that inward man. Let me ask you, how successful are you? We ask that question and we start thinking immediately of ticking off all of the material things that we can that tell us how successful we are, because that's how we gain success. How successful are you spiritually? How successful are you in the inward man striving for eternal glory? As you think about your growth process, are you growing? Is there growth spiritually, in knowledge, in faith, in patience, in long-suffering, in kindness, in love? Is there growth in these areas in you now than 6 months ago, a year ago, from the time you obeyed the gospel of Jesus Christ? Or have you just basically kind of run along and we're the same, generally in those areas as we've always been? Are we renewing that inward man day by day? Are we looking at the things that are not seen because they're eternal? And that's the thing that will disturb me if something gets out of whack there. Not so much so in regard to the things that are material, because they'll pass away anyway. A different kind of perspective in living for heaven. How else does he try to entice us? Well, sometimes he tries to pollute our minds. Even though we come along and we say, well, things that are seen, they don't satisfy. The more you've got, the more you want. And you're all going to leave it here anyway. So don't worry about it. We say that, and then again, what happens? Sometimes we get carried away with the things that are seen again. In regard to this, Paul will say to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6, beginning in verse 6, but godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and raiment, let us therewith be content. Again, he tries to get us to not be caught up to where the devil can choke our spiritual life out of us, because our contentment comes only when we materially are content. He says, rather be content only when things are developing and growing and maturing in a spiritual way. Godliness with contentment, he says, is the great gain. Now, if on the other hand, we're going to look at it from a material standpoint, he says, but they that will be rich, if that's going to be the driving motivation behind our life, hey, I got news for you. If you haven't heard it yet, very much in America right now, that's the driving motivation behind a lot of people. I saw a survey not very long ago taken among first college-age graduates this past year. I guess it was last year. And then high school graduates, and you know what more and more is showing up on the list? The statement of young people that says, I want to be a millionaire by the time I'm 30. And the reason I want to be that is so that then while I'm young enough, I can enjoy all the good things of life. I don't want to wait until I'm 65, because then you're too old to enjoy it. Little do they know much about life at that point. But that's the thinking. And the driving motivation is going to be in those kind of areas. Those who will be rich, what might happen? They'll fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts, which drown men in destruction and perdition. Why do you say that, Paul? Well, for the love of money is the root of all evil, which while some coveted after, do you see the attitude? I'm not saying that you can't be concerned about the material things of this life. All of us have to be, and God recognizes that. He assigned from the very beginning man the responsibility of to work and to care and to provide for. That's one of the duties God gave to man, to provide for his family. But if you will be rich, if that's your motivation, if you covet after the things that are material, what happens? They have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. What is the attitude to be of the child of God who's going to break the pollution of the stranglehold of sin? But thou, O man of God, flee these things and follow after righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, meekness. Fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold on eternal life, whereunto also thou art called and hast professed a good profession before many witnesses. These are the characteristics that need to cause us to break the pollution of sin. I've got a confession to make. That's easy to say and hard to do.
You knew that, didn't you? And do you know why? The reason why is because there is a very strong pressure on all of us to conform, to be like everybody else. You know that as well as I do. The people in the fashion industry know it better than any of us. And all they've got to do is start changing the styles, and do you know what happens? We change right along with them. I mean, let's face it. If ties are wide, you don't come in wearing one that's about that narrow, do you? And if they're narrow, you don't come in wearing one that's real wide. Do you know why? Because even the little kids will point and say, look, he's out of style. And the lapels on suits, they'll get wide and they'll get narrow. And do you know what? Cherie threw away some perfectly good suits of mine when we moved down here because she said, they're not in style anymore. And I refuse to let you wear them. I go off on meetings and come back and don't notice it for a while. But every once in a while, I'll go looking for something in my closet and it will be gone. I can't throw anything away. And the reason is, it's out of style. But I don't care sometimes. I'd still wear it because I'm one of these guys that when I like something and get comfortable with it, that's what I like to stay with. Besides, I know what goes with what. But you know, we just follow right along. They know that. Now let me ask you a question. Who is it most important that you please? Is it God or is it man? If it is God, then it matters not what men say. It matters not as things rise and fall and as situations change. God will be first, and the things that you are will reflect the mind of God in your decisions and in your life. If it is men, in those areas where it doesn't matter, that'll be fine. But in those areas where what men desire or do conflicts with what God would say, and we follow after men, then you see we've got a problem. That's where the devil takes that stranglehold of the pollution of sin on our life to destroy within us, because he tells us, you got plenty of time. You can work it out, you can enjoy the best of life now, and you'll still have time to straighten it out and go to heaven when you die. Who is it most important that you please? And if you don't think there's a real pull to be like everybody else, you're kidding yourself. You know, all you got to do this morning to show this, and I know everybody parks in the back, I'll have to get used to that. So just suppose we go to the back instead of out front. But just suppose this morning somebody goes out back and they start looking up at the top of the back of the building. And they just stand there and look. Pretty soon, what's going to happen? Most all of us that go out is going to stand there and look with them to see what they're looking at, aren't we? That's just about how it works. The idea we want to be like everybody is a very strong pressure. And it's one that we've got to deal with and to realize that there are some things where we can be like others, that's fine. But if it comes in conflict with the will of God, we've got to have the courage and the conviction and the faith to stand up to be what God wants. Now, how can we apply that? Well, maybe the best way we can do it is by turning over to a very familiar example. And that's in the 11th chapter of the book of Hebrews. Look at the life of Abraham here. In verse 8, we're told, by faith, Abraham, when he was called to go into a place which he should after receive for an inheritance, obeyed. And he went out, not knowing whither he went. Have you ever thought about that? God told Abraham, leave Ur of the Chaldees and go to the land that I'll show you. Now, God didn't draw him a map. When we left Barberton, some folks said, tell us how to get to where you are. Draw us a map. Give us some directions. And so I did. God didn't do that to Abraham. He just simply said, you go out and I'll give you a land. I'll show you where to go. I tell you, that'd take a good bit of faith, wouldn't it? I mean, how many of us just would be willing to just jump up and take off and go somewhere
not knowing where we were going. Could you imagine him meeting a caravan as he journeys toward Palestine? Remember, he goes up to Haran first and then down. He goes kind of northwest and then turns back down to the southwest. Can you imagine meeting a caravan going back toward Ur as he goes toward the land God tells him to go to? And the fellow going the other way says, "Where you going, neighbor?" "Oh, no." "How long do you think it's going to take you to get there?" "I don't know." "How are you going to know when you get there?" "I don't know, I just know." I mean, can you imagine what would happen that night around the campfire? Those folks going back toward Ur say, "Boy, that was a weird bunch of folks we passed today. They don't know where they're going, don't know how long it's going to take to get there, and don't even know when they're going to get there." But do you see what he says? He said he obeyed, he went out, even though he didn't know where he was going. God said, "I'll take you." And by faith, he did that. He sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked for a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker was God. Do you see what he's got here? Here's a man who goes out, and the land is going to be his, but when he gets in it, he doesn't dwell there like somebody who's a citizen, but a stranger. And he doesn't buy a portion of land. The only portion of land Abraham bought in the land of promise was that in which he buried his wife. The rest of the time he lived there as if he was a stranger. How can you keep going under those circumstances? He looked for the city whose builder and maker is God. Then drop down to verse 13, which is germane to our point. And he says, these all died in faith, meaning Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who have been introduced in the other verses. Not having received the promises, God said, "I'll give you the land." And Abraham got there and he said, "The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. I'll not give it to you." Isaac came along and he said, "The iniquity of the Amorites is not full. I'll not give it to you." Jacob comes along and he says, "The iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. I'm not ready to drive them out of the land." And he didn't give it to him either. Why didn't they give up and go back home? Because these, having seen them, that is the promises, afar off, and were persuaded of them and embraced them, confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly they seek a country. Now think about it, and truly, this is what Brother Smith said just a minute ago, isn't it? About the fact it's all packed up. Look at what he said. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from which they'd come out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. He says, if they'd have thought about it and looked at the situation and said, everything's strange around here. We don't know any of these stores around here. These streets, they're not the same streets we're used to. And these people and these faces and these names, we're not used to these things. We're trying to break ourselves, and we go back and forth about it right now. When one of us will talk about where we used to live, and we'll still say, home. That's not home anymore. This is home. But you know, if you keep thinking of that as home, you know what's going to happen? You're going to want to go back. You're not going to be very satisfied where you are. It's kind of like the lady that her husband's job took them to Birmingham, Alabama. And if you're from Alabama, I'm sorry about this. But nonetheless, she got up they lived elsewhere. She loved it where she lived before she moved to Birmingham. They lived there 3 years. She got up every morning of the world, I'm told, looked at the mirror at herself and said, "I hate Birmingham." Man, that'd be miserable for 3 years, wouldn't it? And do you know what happened? They became mindful of whence they came out and they went back. But he says, Abraham didn't do that. And Isaac didn't do that. And Jacob didn't do that. Why? Because they now desire a better country, that is in heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. Brethren, that's where we are. We're strangers and pilgrims, all of us. We're not going to feel, Sheree and I and our kids, Aaron and Rusty and Troy. like strangers here very long. We know that because we just have confidence in you. You're not going to let us feel that way. But do you know what? All of us are in this thing together in the world, that we're strangers, pilgrims, and sojourners. Let's impress that here, and we can break the pollution of the stranglehold of sin about trying to destroy heaven from us. Because what that says is, this world is not our home, like we sing. I'm just passing through. You know what? After we agreed to move down here, and even before that, I'd noticed on the weather maps, you look at the weather map of the state of Ohio, and it's got all these places, and Dayton was one of them from Cleveland, where we watched our news. And it'd tell the temperature. And I guess because Cherie's from Kentucky, we looked at Cincinnati and Dayton area to kind of get some idea of how warm it was down here and how cold it was up there. But it had a different appeal after all of a sudden we said, yeah, we're going to move down there. Then I started watching what the temperature was down here about as closely as I was watching what it was up there. And I watched the news two nights since I've been here, and guess what? I've looked back at what Cleveland is living with. After all, we got friends there. Just to kind of see the difference. And I can't wait until I find out they get a major snowstorm this winter and we don't. And I write back and say, ha ha. You see the difference? Of strangers and pilgrims. Unless you're from that area in Northeast Ohio, you might watch like I watched for a long time down here in the Southwest. Just casually. No real interest or appeal. But it's different when there's people that you love and close ties or family or whatever that's there. You feel differently about this world, he says, be a stranger and a pilgrim. Realize that the most important is the city whose builder and maker is God. That's what we're here for. We want to try to help you as you help us be strangers and pilgrims and sojourners in this world, to where we can go to that city whose builder and maker is God, where our citizenship is. For as the Christian that we ought to be, our citizenship's in heaven. And so if you're here this morning as somebody who's not yet named the name of Jesus Christ, then don't be a stranger and a pilgrim to the citizenship that's offered in Jesus, but rather this morning embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ. Believe that he is the Christ, the Son of God. The testimony of reliable witnesses is abundant to verify that he is the Messiah, the Son of God. Be willing to repent of your sins and confess your faith in Christ and be baptized under the remission of sins. If you'll do that this morning, you can leave this place added by the Lord to the church. His blood will cleanse you of every sin and iniquity and hold it against you no more. Doesn't that appeal to you? And then live by faith as you live day by day, that you might ultimately enjoy the beauties of heaven in the afterlife. Won't you do that this morning, making that commitment while we sing?